Russia accuses Ukraine of shelling its own citizens in Kherson as evacuation of civilians begins out of a besieged steel plant in Mariupol. Israel has stepped up its crackdown on the occupied West Bank amid heightened tensions following a Palestinian operation outside its settlements. And the Ain al-Assad military house base housing U.S. troops in western Iraq once again comes under rocket attack. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Fighting continues unabated across Ukraine as the war with Russia enters day 67. The attacks are most fierce in the disputed eastern regions. They also reach as far west as the city of Odessa. Local officials saying that a Russian missile strike from Crimea destroyed the airport runway in the Black Sea port, but no one was harmed. Meantime, in the southern Kherson region, Russia says the Ukrainian shelling of a school, kindergarten, and cemetery has killed and injured civilians. So far, no reaction from Kyiv. In the Russian-held port city of Mariupol, at least 46 civilians, including several children, have managed to leave the besieged steel plant. Ukrainian soldiers and hundreds of civilians are taking shelter at the site. Earlier evacuation efforts have all failed. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid an unannounced visit to Kyiv, where she met with President Volodymyr Zelensky. In a meeting, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
Zelensky thanked the U.S. and his Congress for, in his words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi was being accompanied by several lawmakers on her trip that came after last weekend's visit by the U.S. Secretary of State and Defense to Ukraine. Later in a statement, Pelosi said that Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. alone has already provided $3 billion in aid, and a major increase of such funding, President Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in mostly military assistance. Moscow has warned that aid would only fuel the conflict and raise the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Now, time for news review. Russia says dialogue between Moscow and Washington on strategic stability is now formally frozen. The director of the Russian Foreign Ministry's Department on Non-Proliferation says that contacts could resume after Russia completes its offensive operation in Ukraine. Vladimir Yermakov warned that plans by the U.S. to deploy medium and small-range missiles in Europe will fuel an arms race and worsen the situation. The top diplomat noted the risks of a nuclear war should be kept to a minimum. Yermakov also said that nuclear powers must adhere to the agreed framework aimed at preventing a nuclear war. Tensions have escalated between Russia and the West since Moscow launched a war on Ukraine in February. Time now for some discussion and insight. So joining me will be Alfred Desaius, lawyer, writer, and historian out of Geneva. Also with us will be John Stepling, author and commentator from Indre, Norway. Now, Alfred, this is what Russia talking about, talking of strategic stability. When they did have talks, I mean, I don't remember them to come to any conclusion, anything that Russia wanted, despite all the warnings, whatever the demands, proposals they raised. Now that they're saying it's formally frozen, so what should we be expecting next?
Well, I'm still hoping for common sense to win out. Last June 2021, President Putin and President Joe Biden met here in Geneva, and I commented that meeting. I had great hopes that we in the United States would stop provoking, that we would understand that Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the United Nations Charter prohibits not only the use of force, but also the threat of the use of force. And of course, arming Ukraine to the teeth and sending missiles and heavy weapons in the area and also to Poland and other countries bordering Russia is a threat. So that is in itself a violation of the UN Charter. That doesn't justify the aggression against Ukraine, but you must put it into context. My worry is nuclear war. And my Nordic friends on the Nobel Watch, Nobel Peace Prize Watch committee, Frederick Heffermehl, and a number of American professors, including Richard Falk and myself, signed a Nordic initiative for peace in Ukraine that has been sent to the five heads of state of the Nordic countries. Let's see whether that advances. In any event, it is a serious danger. We cannot afford the use of nuclear weapons, tactical or otherwise, in Europe. The it's the fate of humanity that is at stake. It's not the fate of Ukraine and Russia and the European Union. It's the fate of humanity. So it must be quite clear to everybody that nuclear weapons cannot be used, and the only country thus far that has ever used nuclear weapons is my country, the United States of America, when we carried out indiscriminate bombardment of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of the greatest crimes in human history.
Okay. Now, John, Russia is worried about this arms race, and they're also warning against nuclear war. Are they right?
I think everybody is terrified at the prospect of nuclear war, and you know, the context here, though, I think the propaganda coming from the West has to be countered a little bit, and certain things have to be made clear, because it, when people talk about Russian aggression, the Russian invasion, this has to be clarified. It wasn't unprovoked. If anything, Russia was faced with almost no other option but to defend the people in Donbass and to draw a line stopping the NATO expansion right up to their borders from the U.S.-NATO war machine that has a track record of aggression. I mean, listening to Nancy Pelosi, who can't even get the name of the Ukrainian president correct. She kept calling him Kerensky. When she's talking about this, I mean, she should choke on the hypocrisy. I mean, this is the United States supported head-chopping psychopath ISIS in Syria. It murdered Gaddafi and bombed Libya back into the Stone Age. It occupied Afghanistan for 20 years. The suffering, untold destruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. The CIA has fomented coups around the world, all kinds of covert operations. And most importantly, the U.S. interfered in 96 in the elections in Russia. They openly admitted, they made a Hollywood movie about it, getting Yeltsin elected because he was going to be friendly to Western capital. And that's always the defining motive in things is a business friendly atmosphere for Western capital. Meanwhile, of course, defense industries, you know, reap enormous profit. But the peace negotiations, you know, who violated Minsk I and Minsk II? I mean, it was Ukraine. The U.S. has been in 2014, the second point I meant to make, right, was in 2014, the U.S. fomented a coup in Ukraine. it drove out a Russian-friendly president and replaced him with a Western-friendly president. And it also started pumping billions of dollars into Ukraine in the form of weapons and military training. Military personnel from the United States and Great Britain went in to train these far-right militias, try to put them into some kind of structured form of an actual army. And it has not stopped this funneling of incredible amounts of weaponry, and this is a military, the Ukrainian military, that is deeply infested with neo-Nazis, far-right extremism, open fascism. At one point, Russia, you know, presented 200 war crime accusations to the UN. They were ignored. In 2015, Putin asked for peacekeepers to go to Ukraine and help with the situation. They were ignored. Right. It is the U.S. that has pushed for this war. They are continuing to inflame the situation by rebuffing any kind of peace discussions at all. And now we see celebrities and influencers and all people. Angelina Jolie shows up in Kiev. I mean, the propaganda is just stunning. And it's important to try to counter that Western narrative with something resembling the truth, I think.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments and insight. Alfred Isaias, lawyer, writer, and historian in Geneva. John Stepling, author and commentator from Indre, Norway. And thank you for watching this episode of News Review. Welcome back. Moving on, the Israeli military has a stepped up security crackdown in the occupied West Bank after a guard outside a settlement of Ariel was shot dead on Friday. The military says it's conducted new search operations in Palestinian villages. They also raided the home village of the suspects behind the incident. The military says both suspects have been arrested. Alex Almarter's brigades, the armed wing of the Fatah faction, has claimed responsibility for the shooting. The group says the attack was in response to Israeli violations in Al-Quds that wounded nearly 300 Palestinians in 2 weeks. The regime forces also killed a Palestinian in an operation that they claim was linked to the hunt for the attackers. An event has been held in Russian capital Moscow to mark International Goods Day. A correspondent, Marina Kortanova, was there and filed the report.
The Islamic Republic of Iran hosted an event devoted to commemorating Quds Day as part of Moscow's Ramadan Tent, an annual charitable event organized by the Russian Council of Muftis and the Iranian Embassy in Moscow. The International Quds Day, a day of solidarity with the Palestinian people, created by Ayatollah Khamenei, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
It was a wise decision by Imam Khomeini to designate Quds Day. Using the example of the Palestinians, everyone should think about their own people and the equality of their rights. For me, Al-Quds is a symbol of a struggle for justice. That struggle is led by Iranians who have greatly contributed to the triumph of justice across the world.
I have learned from Palestinians that the struggle for justice is of greater value than religious and political doctrines. Quds Day, designated by Imam Khomeini as a day of solidarity with the Palestinians, teaches us the same thing. Palestine shows the power of faith in justice to resist powerful empires that are armed with modern weapons. Palestinian youths are only armed with stones, and all these people are armed with their faith in God.
Pro-Palestinian activists say making the International Quds Day is even more important today than when it was first declared in 1979, as the Israeli regime has grown more reckless and violent to the people of Palestine.
Iranian ambassador reminded that the issue of Al-Quds is not a private or personal, but international, as thousands of Palestinians were murdered and hundreds of thousands of refugees were forced to flee their homes since the beginning of the formation of Israel.
After the Camp David Treaty, the Zionist regime meant that the Islamic State would no longer resist and the Zionists would continue to expand their occupation. They suddenly ran into the approach of Imam Khomeini. He announced the Day of Al-Quds, mobilized all freedom-loving people who resist oppression against Israel. Muslims and non-Muslims rose up in support of the people of Palestine.
Marina Kortanova, Moscow.
A couple of rockets have targeted a base hosting U.S.-led coalition troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. According to security sources, the projectiles crashed near the Ain al-Assad complex without causing any casualties or damage. A group that calls itself International Resistance says it was behind the attack. American troops and interests in Iraq have frequently come under rocket and drone strikes in recent months. Anti-U.S. sentiment sharply rose in Iraq after January 2020. That's when the U.S. assassinated Iran's anti-terror commander, General Soleimani, and Iraqi commander al-Muhandis in a drone strike near Baghdad airport. Within days, the Iraq parliament passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all foreign troops. The coalition ended its combat mission there last December, but roughly 3,500 soldiers remain deployed in a so-called advisory and training role. An explosion targeting a mosque in the Afghan capital Kabul has killed at least 50 worshippers. The Daesh terrorist group says that its operatives were behind the bloodshed. It drew many condemnations, including one from the UN that said attacks against civilians are prohibited under international humanitarian law. Also on Saturday, a car bomb explosion in Kabul left one person dead and three others wounded. Several back-to-back terrorist attacks in recent weeks have raised security fears on the eve of Eid al-Fitr, a religious occasion that's celebrated at the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. Now moving on, a funeral procession has been held for veteran Iranian movie producer and director Nader Talabzadeh, who passed away at the age of 69 2 days ago. A huge crowd of mourners attended the funeral service in Tehran on Sunday. Talabzadeh is known for his award-winning documentaries and TV productions. He was also the secretary of the International New Horizon Conference, an annual event serving as a platform for criticizing U.S. and Israeli policies. That led to him being blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington. Talabzadeh died of heart disease complications on the 29th of April. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. The Holy Quran shows us the path to confront the enemy, patience and piety. Later on, I will expand on the meaning of piety in these cases. Therefore, we are confident that the promise of Quran is a true promise. There is no shred of doubt about it, but if you are constant and do right, not the least harm will their cunning do to you. That is, their tricks will not affect you in any way and will not push you back. This is a divine promise. First of all, what does patience mean, but if you are constant and right? It means not becoming tired. In many Farsi translations, patience has been defined as resistance and steadfastness. This is correct. It means not becoming tired, even if they refer to it as tolerance. It means not becoming tired. This is what patience means. Not becoming tired. The same is true of patience in praying and in the face of sins. Some sins are attractive and they pull us towards them, but we show resistance. This resistance might make us tired and one might give up. This is a dangerous poison.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Patience means not becoming tired. It holds true for sins and for confronting the enemy. This is what patience means. It means not fleeing the arena. This is patience. What does piety mean? It means taking complete care of oneself. Piety means this in every area. The best of provisions is piety. Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 197. Wherever in the Quran, piety means complete care of oneself, just like a person who walks on a scrubland wearing a long garment, such as the garment of us clergy. Well, one takes care not to let the thorns get stuck in our clothes. We take care step by step. We look under our feet and we look for places where there are fewer thorns. We look under our feet and we look forward. This is piety. Piety, which is commonly defined as fear of God, means this. Fear of God has such a meaning. It means taking care not to take action against God's commands.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachment and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian President agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So, I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
Israel is stepping up its atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli forces have shot and killed a young Palestinian man in Jenin. The man was identified as 21-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Lutfi Massad. He was a resident of the town of Burkin. He was killed during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the early hours of Wednesday. Officials say Massad had been shot in the head. Three other Palestinians with moderate wounds were transferred to the medical facility as well. The Israeli troops broke into dozens of homes and violently searched them, causing excessive property damage before detaining at least three Palestinians. Massad's death follows that of another Palestinian killed on Tuesday when Israeli forces stormed a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Uwaidat was killed during the shooting in Akabat Jaber camp near Ariha. Nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis since the start of 2022. Jenin has become the target of increasing Israeli military raids, arrests, and targeted assassinations in an attempt to crack down on growing Palestinian armed resistance there. The regime in Tel Aviv has escalated its crackdown on Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. It has also arrested dozens of Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds and desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, I think clearly Israel is trying to provoke the Palestinians. You know, this is just part of their long-term campaign of wanting to take more and more land from the Palestinians. To take over holy sites in Jerusalem that they want for themselves. And Again, they're trying to provoke a response that would justify a greater military incursion, I think, into places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate.
The regime has further imposed new restrictions on the Palestinian people's entry into the mosque and ordered the demolition of Palestinian homes and agricultural facilities. There are fears of a possible large-scale Israeli invasion of Jenin Camp. The armed wings of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah movements are active there. Last week, settler incursions under police protection led to daily confrontations with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Many Palestinians were injured and arrested. The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas has also harshly warned Israel against further atrocities against Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli threats would not discourage the Palestinian people from keeping up their legitimate struggle against the occupying regime.
Well, again, I think Israel's plan is to take over all of Palestine, to push the Palestinians farther and farther out of, in particular, the West Bank, but also Gaza. I mean, it's really a genocidal plan, right? I mean, the plan is either to starve out the Palestinians, force them to leave as refugees, as many have, so that Israel can take over the entire, piece of land there.
The heightened tensions come as people around the world are gearing up for Quds Day rallies around the world. The annual event is held on the last Friday of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979 to express solidarity with Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism. Palestinians have called on Muslim nations to play a more assertive role in securing the cessation of the Israeli regime's occupation.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its Western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated. Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movement in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable, and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily, because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
In a recent report by the New York Times, Canada's main city of Toronto was described as the Wild West of marijuana shops. According to the report, Ontario's provincial government permitted the shops by emergency order to keep operating during the COVID-19 pandemic, even during lockdowns. During this period, to the investors' delight, shares in the stocks of licensed medical marijuana growers in Canada have multiplied in price. However, the marijuana business was already expected to flourish, even before the pandemic started in 2019 and right after Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to fulfill a campaign promise, introduced legislation to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Canada. The prospects look good. Eventually, the Government of Canada legalized cannabis for recreational use on October 17, 2018. The Cannabis Act creates a legal and regulatory framework for controlling the production, distribution, sale, and possession of cannabis in Canada. Canada is now the second nation after Uruguay to completely legalize marijuana as a consumer product, in an effort to extinguish the criminal trade and keep the substance out of the hands of youth by regulating the market. However, growing, importing, exporting, or selling marijuana, particularly to minors, outside licensed channels, remain a serious crime. Meanwhile, critics of the cannabis law highlight the damaging impact to society of the widespread use of the drugs. When the use of cannabis becomes more widespread, the drug can also have downsides, including acute injuries and illnesses. In some cases, marijuana could lead to cyclical vomiting syndrome, a condition characterized by vomiting and severe abdominal pain. And also, those who use cannabis are more prone to mental illnesses. While many shops remain closed in Toronto, following several rounds of lockdowns and many office towers in the city remain mostly empty, the marijuana shops apparently have a booming business. They were permitted by the provincial government's emergency order to keep operating during the pandemic. In March 2020, during the early months of the pandemic, there were only 12 cannabis shops, but now there are 430 shops, with another 88 in the approval process. When Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government legalized marijuana in 2018, its primary goal was to create a more equitable justice system by putting an end to heavily racialized arrests, possession, not a major new business sector. According to a recent government-sponsored report, in only 3 years, sales of legal marijuana in Ontario have outpaced estimates of unlicensed sales and boosted the economy by $10.6 billion. Polls indicate that more Canadians consume it than they did before, 25% of people 16 and up.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hello.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. The pleasure is all ours. Sheikh, today I would like to talk about quite an important question, as most of these questions, to be fair, honestly are. But this one, it struck a nerve, because it deals with not just this question as a part of a bigger misunderstanding in Islam. And that is about, why is it that we, as Muslims, they say, we believe that a fetus, it goes to heaven when it dies in the womb of the parent, for example. Like, they ask the listener, did the fetus even do anything to earn entry to heaven? So what do you say to this question, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It seems that the dear questioner did not care about the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because we are talking about the most merciful that we call it in Islamic term, وَهُوَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. The most merciful of all mercifuls. You see, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to the verse of Noble Quran, we have that وَرَحْمَتِي وَسَعَدْ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ. My mercy and my graces and my blessing has covered all creatures. And because of that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he would deal with people with his mercy. And we always ask him to deal with us with his mercy, not with his justice. Okay? Right. It is one of the famous supplications that we always, have this supplication and whisper it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that, oh, my Lord, please deal with me in the day of judgment with your mercy, not with your justice. And talking about this question, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will deal with this fetus or baby according to his mercy, okay?
Right.
And this mercy require him to put him in his paradise. You see that if you go to the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, we find out that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala not only dealing with this fetus with his mercy and this baby and this fetus going to the paradise, but he would give him the power and the privilege of intercession.
As well,
yes. And this fetus going to intercede for his or her parents. We have a couple of narration has been quoted in here that this fetus will intercede for his parents. And we have other narrations talking about the babies and fetus who are, did not have enough opportunity to live in this world and how they are going to be in the day of judgment. And a very interesting narration, if you refer, let me share one of the narrations talking about this issue. Of course, talking about the babies of the faithful people, but maybe we can do it and by the same idea we can... By the same criteria, you can do it for the, other fetus of the faithful people. إذا مات طفل من أطفال المؤمنين نادى مناد في ملكوت السماوات والأرض ألا إن فلان ابن فلان قد مات. When the baby of the faithful people would die, a person and the angel would declare that this baby has been died. And the narration continues until we say that حَتَّى دُفِئَ إِلَيْهِ يَغْذُوهُ فَإِذَا كَانَ مَاتَ وَالِدَهُ أَوْ أَحَدُهُمَا أَوْ بَعْضُ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ دُفِئَ إِلَيْهِ يَغْذُوهُ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, again, according to his mercy, would give this baby of the faithful people to his parents or one of the close relative of him or her, just to, feed him or feed her, okay? And then وَإِلَّا دُفَأَ إِلَى فَاطِمَةَ غَذُو. If in a case that none of his parents or close relatives has been died or passed away, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would give this baby to Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha.
To that extent. Yeah, great to this mercy.
Yeah, according to his great mercy, to Lady Fatima to feed this baby. Yeah. حَتَّى يَغْدُمَ أَبَوَاهُ أَوْ أَحَدُهُمَا أَوْ بَعْضُ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ فَتَدْفَأُهُ إِلَيْهِ. Lady Fatima would, you know, feed this baby until the one of the parents or one of the close relatives comes, which means that they pass away. And yes, and receive the same baby of the faithful people. You see how, yes, merciful Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dealing with these babies of the faithful people.
Of course, it goes without saying that the family members of this child must be faithful Muslims who will go to heaven, not just anybody, right?
Of course, yes, of course. In this case, that the, you know, the parents should be faithful people. But sometimes, as I said, according to other narration has been quoted, that maybe this baby, given the power of intercession, given the privilege of having intercession for his or her parents.
Right.
You know, the cases are different. Maybe sometimes when, you know, the condition for intercession has been met, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give it to this baby, that this baby that we are talking about having some intercession for his or her parents.
Right. There is some narrations, and I quote one saying that a child who has died young will be asked to enter heaven, and it will stand at its gates and say, I will not enter heaven until or unless my parents enter heaven with me. So we do have this narration, but there's also another question. Since you quoted the narration of Lady Fatima Zahra alayhi salam about feeding this child, do children need to be fed in the afterlife, dear Sheikh?
Yeah, you know, talking about the, you know, the day of the after the demise of people, maybe there are some need. Of course, we do not have enough study about that, enough information about that, whether they require any specific food, whether this food is a spiritual or, for example, let's say material one. We do not have enough information about that. But after all, this baby, maybe it is referring to kind of, maybe, you know, if it is a spiritual one, maybe it's referring to some kind of a spiritual food, which means that this baby, after all, needs some kind of care and affection of his parents. But because when he or she lacked the affection of his parents, Lady Fatima would do it in a state of his parents.
Right, okay. So another question, dear Sheikh. Do children grow in paradise? Because if this child is an infant, they will forever remain an infant, or will they grow to become a grown-up? Or do we not have any information about this in the hadiths?
About the talking, because you see that we are talking about the world of Barzakh, you know, all this story that we are mentioning here, this information that we are talking about is dealing with the time of Barzakh. Barzakh means a mediatory world between this material world and the Day of Judgment, okay?
Right.
If we talk about the Day of Judgment, maybe the idea is quite clear. Because in the Day of Judgment, we have this material life and physical body of human being would arise. And we have the same body, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give reward to the same physical body or punish it, okay? But talking about the Barzakh, after all, we do not have the same physical body, but we have Badani Mithali. Okay, which we call it has some characteristic of physical body, but not all characteristic of that.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
According to Hukama and Islamic philosophers, this the world of Barzakh has some kinds of characteristic of physical body. I mean, the bodies of the dead people in that world has some of the characteristic of physical body, not all of that.
Why?
Okay, and of course, maybe again, we do not have. Of course, I do not have sufficient information about that, whether we would have the growth of the bodies or not. But what we have in our narration, and I have checked it out, is talking about the punishment in that time for the, of course, for the sinners in the world of Barzakh. And for example, having and giving some reward for those people who are righteous people. But about the other characteristic, whether we have the growth of body, which kind of food that we need, we are not sure about that. We can have some presumption here, but after all, the idea is not clear, at least for me.
Right. Dear Sheikh, let's just circle back to our main topic and about this fetus that dies and goes to heaven. Does it deserve to go to heaven? Or is it just out of the mercy of Allah, as you've said, that it enters heaven?
I can say that nobody deserves to go to the heavens.
Right.
Okay, to the heaven. All people, they go, and at least most of the people that they go to the heaven, okay?
Right.
They are only for the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
But this mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala requires for the righteous people to go to the heavens. Nobody can say that I deserve to go to the heaven.
It is my right.
It is my right. Please give my right and so on and so forth. It's only because of the mercy of Allah. Because after all, we are weak human beings. We have lots of deficiency. Yeah.
Right, yes.
We have a lot of weak points. Of course, I'm talking about the ordinary people. So we need the mercy. We need mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the blessing of Him in order to go to the paradise and enjoy the, that ni'mat and the blessing of Allah in that paradise.
One final question for you, dear Sheikh, and we will end today's program. And that is, isn't it unfair for the other Muslims like me and you, for example, who have to live this long life with so many troubles and problems and being tested constantly, when this fetus hasn't even been born yet and it goes to heaven? Isn't that unfair and not just?
Of course it is, according to the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, that because this fetus did not have the opportunity of having life in this world, okay? And, after all, it requires that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala deal this fetus or baby of the faithful people according to His mercy and blessing, okay? But when we talk about the human being has been lived in this world and he did or she did his best, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala again dealing the same person and individual again with His mercy and blessing, okay?
Right.
I want to say that whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doing is according to His justice and according to His mercy, okay? I want to say that there is no injustice in the, actions of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
And with that, dear Sheikh, we will unfortunately have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you, dear Sheikh, for joining us today and for sharing with us your knowledge. And also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حساب
حزنا يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Communicate. As the end of Ramadan slowly approaches, so do the celebrations of Quds Day. So people from all across the world take to the streets in a show of support for Palestine, to express their love for the holy city of Jerusalem or Al-Quds, and to express their firm opposition to Zionism and Israeli occupation. Now, given the recent crackdowns, the attacks by Israel in the occupied West Bank, and of course, the attacks against worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the marches, the commemorations, the celebrations of Quds Day are frankly more relevant than ever. So let's take a look at how Quds Day came into being, how it spread and grew in popularity to become what is really an international event, and why it is more relevant today than ever before in the face of Israel's illegal occupation of Al-Quds and oppression of Palestinians. I'm your host, Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Now, before we get into Quds Day and what it means, history behind it, how it came into being, I wanted to take just a tiny moment, just a brief moment, to maybe go into the word itself, right? Because usually when people talk about the capital of Palestine, they say Jerusalem. But in Arabic, in Persian, in Urdu, in Turkish, and in many languages, we don't say Jerusalem, we say Al-Quds. Now, the word Quds is actually a very ancient word. It's a Semitic word. You see it used even in Aramaic and Ugaritic, and you know, back then and still to this day, Quds means holy, right? It can also mean purity or blessing. In Arabic, when you say Muqaddas, it means blessed or holy. When we say Jerusalem, we say Al Quds or Al Bayt Al Muqaddas, the holy home or holy house. When Christians refer to the Bible in Arabic, they say Al-Kitab Al-Muqaddas. It means the holy book. And so the city itself, Jerusalem or Al-Quds, its very name being associated with the word holy really speaks volumes. I think it really says a lot of how special this city is for all the main three monotheistic religions, right? Of course, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The Jews, they have the Western Wall. The Christians have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Al-Quds is, of course, where Jesus Christ preached, was crucified, and then resurrected.